At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'm reasonably sure it's not a day of note on most conventional calendars, but by corporate America's way of marking time, today's a biggie. Alcoa started off first quarter earnings season today. It's traditionally the first of the blue chips to report on its bottom line. And while everything is bright and shiny for the aluminum manufacturer, the same probably cannot be said about the rest of the gang. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Duke Executive MBA, developing leaders and accelerating careers around the world with four top-ranked executive MBA programs for working professionals. More at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 10th of April, Tuesday. Good to have you here. The world's biggest aluminum company said after the bell today, profits jumped 9% the first 3 months of the year. It was not an entirely unexpected announcement. Commodity prices are high and rising. All in all, though, corporate earnings are expected to come in fairly ho-hum this time around. And you know what? People are okay with that. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more now from New York.
Corporate America has posted 14 consecutive quarters of double-digit earnings growth. That's 3.5 years. But as we head into this earnings season, analysts predict S&P 500 companies will report only around 3.5% growth. Market strategist Ernie Ankrum with Russell Investment Group says that's not such a bad thing.
We need the economy to slow down in order for the Fed to have some help in fighting inflation.
Ankrum says corporate profits are finally responding to a slowing global economy, but he points out 3.5% growth is still growth. Investment strategist Jim Paulson with Wells Capital Management suspects earnings actually grew by more like 5 or 6% last quarter.
The way the pattern goes with estimates is you start low, and then as the earnings come out, you raise them. It seems a good bet that that might be what we do again.
That's partly why analysts don't expect Wall Street to freak out over slowing growth. For weeks, corporations have been slashing their earnings guidance. Analysts, in turn, have cut their expectations. Russell Investments' Ernie Ankrum says the market has already priced in the quarter.
The market doesn't mind bad news as long as it's not a surprise bad news.
Just a handful of major companies are reporting in the next few days, so any big surprises probably won't come until next week when the onslaught begins. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There's energy news out of Texas this afternoon. The utility TXU agreed to a $32 billion private equity buyout back in February, and it agreed to steer away from a widely used but heavily polluting energy source, coal. Today, the company said it's keeping its promise and then some. In fact, TXU's scrapping its plans for coal-fired facilities and now wants to build some of the biggest nuclear power plants the United States has ever seen. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports on an industry that's been out of favor for a very long time.
If you're in the energy business these days, there are a couple things you not just want, but need. production plants that are always on but are cost-effective to keep running, and energy sources that don't incur the wrath of environmentalists, much less the government, who many believe might soon cap carbon emissions or tax them. That's why you're seeing all these pledges to wean off coal and go nuclear.
It is a question of what else do you do?
That's Joan Lin Wong of Cambridge Energy Research Associates. She says the thing is, since no one's built any nuclear reactors lately, there are a lot of question marks about them.
The substantial uncertainty on how much it actually will eventually cost to build these plants, but based on, you know, some estimates, it's attractive enough for a lot of companies to try.
Opponents of nuclear power say one big reason nuclear is attractive is the $13 billion in government subsidies that are out there. Michael Marriott is with Nuclear Information Resources Services. He says already three other energy companies have proposed nuclear power plants.
Once the subsidies vanish, I expect a lot of these projects will vanish too.
Some wonder how TXU can actually build the reactor for the price it says it can. But Marriott says the bigger question is why TXU would make such an announcement when, with a buyout offer on the table, the company soon could be under new management. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
And a quick correction from yesterday's broadcast. We told you about the president's immigration speech, and we heard from a group called the National Immigration Forum. We described it as favoring amnesty for undocumented immigrants. They called to tell us that although they are for comprehensive immigration reform, they don't favor amnesty. Something happened in New York today that hasn't happened in 4 years. The Dow finished on the upside for the eighth straight day, but only by about this much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Vermont prides itself on being different than other states. It was the last state in the union where Walmart was able to open a shop, for example. And it's now the place where Detroit's chosen to fight proposed limits on carbon dioxide emissions. A federal trial started today in Burlington over the state's regulation of CO2. Dan Esty teaches environmental law at Yale University. Professor Esty, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
The Supreme Court decided last week a very important emissions case, ruling that the EPA does have the authority to regulate carbon dioxide. What exactly is at issue in this case up in Vermont?
Well, in Vermont, we've got the case where a state, in this case Vermont, has decided to step up and regulate carbon dioxide in the coming years. And this is something that not only Vermont is doing, but they're all nine other states, along with Vermont, are trailing in the wake of California that chose to do this in 2005. So we have an interesting question where the automakers are saying, no, 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 states cannot regulate greenhouse gas emissions. This is something only a federal government can do.
And what they're saying is that basically the costs of compliance are too high, the deadlines are unrealistic. Do you think that's going to hold any water with a federal trial?
I'm really not sure that it will. I think what we have is a changed circumstance from the past. We now recognize that the science of climate change, while still having some uncertainties in it, is clear enough to justify real action. And there's going to have to be dramatic change made across all of the sectors, including the auto industry, where greenhouse gases are emitted. So I think the question about whether things are technologically feasible is going to be a hard case to make for the auto industry.
If the auto industry fails in this case, that is, if the states win, would we then face 50 different regulations across the country on carbon dioxide?
That's certainly the concern that the auto industry will raise in this case. They're going to say, well, even if there's a problem here, we don't want 50 different state standards. But that's something of a red herring. There's not really a risk of that. What the Clean Air Act, our federal Clean Air Act, says is that California, given its historic challenge with air pollution, is permitted to set different standards. And then states are permitted to sign on to the California rule if they prefer, as opposed to a more lax federal rule. So we're really at risk of only two standards. And the fact that you've got so many states stepping up to the California standard, to the state standard that in this case is going to be tougher than the federal one, simply signals, I think, that we've had a policy failure at the federal level. We have a federal structure, a policymaking system led by the Bush administration that has not produced a vibrant and serious response to climate change. And this is a signal that the American public, and particularly the governors of many states, want to see action.
So where does this wind up? If Detroit, well, appeal, I guess, would be certain, right?
I think there's going to be an appeal whichever side wins, whichever side loses. I think there's a particularly tough case for Detroit to make here, and it's because it's not as though everybody's having trouble here. And one of the big issues that's going to emerge in the case is the auto industry's demand for secrecy. They really want limited press coverage of this trial. They don't want to have to talk about what technologies they have in place. And frankly, I think they're fearful that if Detroit is allowed to or required to put forward its information alongside what the Japanese are capable of, it will become quite apparent that Japan has been thinking strategically about environmental issues, and they have a vehicle fleet and a portfolio of cars that are going to be rolled out over the next 2 years or 3 years that are really quite capable of meeting these standards. And Detroit is complaining that it couldn't possibly do it and that it'll have no cars to sell 5 or 10 years from now. And I think that argument, the suggestion that somehow there shouldn't be a public conversation about this, that these things should be kept secret, particularly when it will reveal simply bad management decisions on the part of the automakers in Detroit, is going to be really an interesting thing to see play out.
Dan Esty is a professor of environmental law and policy at Yale University. Professor Esty, thanks a lot for your time.
A pleasure to be with you.
$200,000 Americans had bariatric surgery last year. That's operations like stomach stapling and stomach bypass to control obesity. Still, a report out from RAND yesterday said 3% of the population is now 100 pounds or more overweight. The government puts the medical cost of that obesity at about $200 billion a year. Fat rights activists, their phrase, not ours, question that figure, and they question the usefulness of one common measurement of obesity, the body mass index. But even they admit there are costs of carrying too much flesh on your bones. Here's Helen Palmer from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH with the second report in our occasional series on the economic effects of fat.
Hello. Welcome.
Hi.
Martha Dolan welcomes me to her home in Lexington, Massachusetts. She's 50, a marketing manager for Philips, and carries 149 pounds on a 5 foot 7 inch body. Before she had gastric bypass surgery, she weighed 100 pounds more.
The cost is interesting because, you know, you wear out furniture, you wear out beds, you wear out your car seat. You know, when you weigh more than the things are designed for, things break.
That's happened, says Dolan, a chair collapsing when she sat on it. Everyone laughed, but the effect of pounds on dollars is no joke. Jay Zagorski is an economist at Ohio State University. For 29 years, with data from a Department of Labor long-term study, he's correlated wealth and weight, plotting participants' BMI, body mass index, against their total assets.
People with high BMI tend to have low wealth. Exactly how much? Well, people who are in the obese category have half the wealth of normal people.
Zagorski says each point on the BMI scale boosts or slashes your net worth by $1,300. He points out he can't say that carrying extra pounds causes poverty. It could be the other way round. Still, changes in weight do affect wealth.
Losing 2 pounds is not going to make you any richer. But people who had dramatic changes in their body mass, either up or down, tended to have relatively large increases or decreases in their net worth.
Research is less clear when it comes to wages. But Marilyn Won, who calls herself
a smart, sassy fat chick,
says some studies have looked into this.
One New England Journal of Medicine survey found that fatter women's household income was nearly $7,000 less per year than their average weight counterparts.
Discrimination's rife in the workplace, she says. Human resource managers say things like, well, you don't fit the corporate image. As a businesswoman, Martha Dolan says she missed out when she weighed 250 pounds.
If you are very obese, people are not inclined to put you in front of a crowd and have you speak and have you escort customers. You know, they're more likely to pick someone else. So there's sort of an opportunity cost.
What turned Marilyn Won from a writer into a fat rights activist was health insurance.
Instead of paying, you know, maybe $275, that would be the rate that they would charge me for my age and my health level without looking at weight. Instead, I pay now nearly $900 every month for health insurance.
That's more than her rent in San Francisco, says Juan. Fat people pay more for other things, too. Take clothes. Brandy Mancuso, a baker who weighed 320 pounds before she had bypass surgery, says bigger sizes in specialist stores just cost a lot more.
The first coat I bought at Lane Bryant was $149. And if I could have gone to TJ Maxx then, I just bought one the other day, $30.
Okay, well, here's my closet. And you can see I've changed over my wardrobe from the large ladies to the normal size clothing.
Martha Dolan echoes Brandy Mancuso. She had a wardrobe full of expensive fat clothes.
I was probably spending double what my colleagues would spend because if I found something that fit me, I had to buy it.
Both of them say they've saved over $100 a month on their food bills. They can eat only tiny meals since their operations. And Mancuso's saving cash on her car.
I kept going through tires. And I'm like, why am I going through so many sets of tires? It's a brand new car. They're like, well, it's your weight. So now that I'm smaller, I don't have to go through many sets of tires.
Dolan and Mancuso chose the radical step of surgery to shrink their stomachs. They feel they fit in better now, and it's saving them cash. Marilyn Wan's chosen a different path. She wants to change attitudes. She says she's healthy, she exercises and eats well, and she's not ashamed of her 285-pound, 5'4" body.
I love the F word. I love it. Fat! Now loud and proud from the belly. Fat! Ah, I love that word.
In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Coming up, the problem with being on the wrong side of Hugo Chavez.
These people have now been identified as enemies of the state. Many people have lost their job. Others cannot be hired. It's also generated outward migration. People have begun to leave in relatively large numbers.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow edged up 4 points to close at 12,573. The Nasdaq climbed a third of 1%, 8 points, and wrapped up trading at 2477. And the S&P 500 tacked on 3 points, 0.25% to end at 1448. Oil stocks floated to the top thanks to a rebound in the price of crude. Refinery troubles have led to reduced U.S. gasoline inventories. That news helped Chevron shares gain more than 2%. Stock in ConocoPhillips rose 1.5%. ExxonMobil shares picked up 1%. Maybe it was just coincidence, but there was a blip in the value of Comcast stock moments before the close, just about the time Comcast's E! Entertainment Television was flashing the big news. Anna Nicole Smith's former boyfriend, Larry Burkhead, he's the father of her baby. So, in case you missed it somehow, now you know, but you don't have to spread it around that you heard it here. Comcast shares closed up almost 1% today. The price of the 10-year T-note rose. That pushed the yield down to 4.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. And by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. AngiesList.com. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Treasury Department reports on the federal budget for March. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger delivers the keynote at an environmental leadership conference at Georgetown University. And the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee discusses the availability and affordability of property and casualty insurance in the Gulf and other coastal regions. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It is not a Wall Street scandal, but it's got all the hallmarks of one. Kickbacks in return for market access, shady dealings between marketers and banks, and no real regulations covering most of what's been going on. Investigations into the student loan industry continue to widen. Schools and lenders are putting people on paid leave while everybody sorts things out. Today, New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo compared his probe to the peeling of an onion. He said he's discovering layer after layer of wrongdoing. Stephen Bird follows education policy at the New America Foundation. Mr. Bird, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, the first thing that came to my mind when this story broke was, what are the rules about this? Is any of what's been happening illegal?
Not necessarily, particularly from the federal standpoint. Now, I know that the Attorney General of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, is looking at this as it applies to New York state law. But what I'm familiar with is Federal Higher Education Act. And that act includes a very general statement barring lenders in the student loan programs from offering inducements to colleges to get student loan business. The problem is that language in the law is very general, and it's not clear that any of the allegations actually are illegal, but they do appear to raise serious questions in terms of conflicts of interest.
What does this say about the state of competition in this market? It must be reasonably cutthroat out there. If banks and lenders are offering all these inducements to these college staff people to get them to sort of go behind students' backs.
It is extremely competitive right now. The dirty little secret of the federal loan program is just how concentrated it is. Only 32 lenders currently hold 90% of the student loan volume. And what's more, the Education Department has found that at about 300 colleges, one lender controls 99% of the loan volume, essentially giving those lenders monopolies on those campuses. So what's happened is new companies trying to break into the market have had to rely on unconventional means. The Attorney General of New York has been questioning some of them, including revenue sharing arrangements in which colleges get a cut of each loan that they provide to their students.
How did we get to this point where the market is so locked up?
Federal officials have really turned a blind eye to the problems that are occurring in the student loan program and the amount of concentration that there is in the program, as well as the types of inducements that lenders are using to win business. When it came to power, the Bush administration really sort of have a reverence for the private sector, and they rewarded loan industry officials and lobbyists with prominent positions throughout the Education Department. Meanwhile, lenders such as Sallie Mae, the biggest loan provider in the country, have showered Congress with hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions. So there's really been a cozy relations that have developed between the Bush administration, the Republican-led Congress, and lenders, and they really left the loan industry very unregulated.
Make a guess for me. How long is it going to be before Congress starts hearings on this and we have a whole new set of regulations about the student loan industry?
Right now, it seems like the Democrats in control of Congress and in the key committees are really sort of starting their own investigations. They've sent letters to different colleges and to the Education Department asking for various documents related to the relationships and arrangements. I'm guessing, though, that there will be hearings coming up fairly soon. Senator Kennedy has already introduced a bill called the Student Loan Sunshine Act, which is trying to get more disclosure about these types of arrangements that lenders and colleges have entered into. But I believe that with some of the latest revelations, Senator Kennedy and others will be toughening up the legislation they were considering offering.
Stephen Bird at the New America Foundation. He's a senior research fellow there. Mr. Bird, thanks a lot for your time.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The House Judiciary Committee sent Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez a little note today. Part of it was in Latin. The word subpoena was right up at the top of the page. Congress is looking for more information about the firing of those eight U.S. attorneys as the drama moves into the political arena. There is a somewhat similar controversy going on in Venezuela. The politics of the two presidents involved, Chavez and Bush, couldn't be more different. But critics in Caracas say there is blatant political discrimination happening against some government workers there and on a much wider scale. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gratch reports.
Rocío San Miguel worked as an attorney for 13 years with the Venezuelan government. In December 2003, she signed a petition to recall President Hugo Chavez, who she felt was abusing his power. The names of those who signed were leaked to a Chavez loyalist, Congressman Luis Tascón, and posted on his website.
Yo llamo al pueblo venezolano a revisar y que salgan
Chavez even promoted the site live on national TV.
www.luistascón.com. Métanse allí.
1 month after she signed, San Miguel was summoned into her boss's office.
He told me that unfortunately he had to fire me. He said, how could it have occurred to you to sign against the guy who pays you?
San Miguel experienced a cascade of emotions.
Indignada, impotente, angustiada.
Indignation, impotence, anguish. I knew right away that something terrible was happening to me, and I began to collect evidence.
San Miguel was one of three people in her office who signed the petition against Chavez. All three were fired. The Venezuelan Constitution forbids discriminating against employees for their political beliefs. Nonetheless, according to the Organization of American States, the Chavez administration has shown a growing tendency to intimidate, harass, and stigmatize the opposition. The Public Employees Union in Venezuela documented 780 cases of political discrimination, including 200 firings. Wesleyan University's Francisco Rodriguez says this amounts to economic blackmail.
Okay, so you want to become an opponent of Chavez? That's going to have a high cost. You're not going to have a job.
Political patronage has always been a part of the landscape here in Venezuela. But Reardon Rowett with Johns Hopkins University says Chavez has turned ideological discrimination into a science.
Really has become a monstrous mechanism for placing fear in the hearts of many Venezuelans.
3.5 million people signed a petition against Chavez in 2003.
These people have now been identified as enemies of the state. Many people have lost their job. Others cannot be hired. It's also generated outward migration. People have begun to leave in relatively large numbers.
Rowett says the government is accused of using the list to screen applicants for social programs, scholarships, even credit from state banks.
And so it really has become a black list, almost in the way you had lists in totalitarian Europe in the 1930s.
The difference is this list takes advantage of 21st century technology. A simple computer program, searchable by name or ID number, contains the political preferences of 14 million Venezuelans. It's called the MySanta program, after Chavez's great-grandfather. Venezuelan Communications Minister William Lara, as well as Ambassador to the U.S. Bernardo Álvarez, declined requests for comment.
Entiérrese la lista de Luis Tascón.
Under international pressure, Chavez called for the list to be buried 2 years ago, saying it had outlived its usefulness. The problem is no one can be sure the list is truly buried. To this day, street vendors in Caracas sell the MySanta program for about $5. Regardless of whether the blacklist is actually being used, many people still think it is. That seed of doubt has infected the entire society.
That's a subtle part. That's the dangerous part. That's the sad part.
Filmmaker Francisco Moreno made a documentary called The List, A Society Under Suspicion.
I could never know if I'm being denied the right to work or being denied a contract with the government or being denied a film grant because those guys know that I signed. It's McCarthy all over again.
After she got fired, Rocío San Miguel has not been able to find work as an attorney. She's taken her evidence to the Venezuelan courts, but they're packed with Chavez supporters. She's now waiting on an appeal to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. In Caracas, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, what do you think $1,900 a month might get you in Manhattan? If you're really lucky, probably a really small studio apartment, or, as it turns out, a 6x6 cubicle. Office space on the island now runs more than $53 a square foot on average. A spot on Park Avenue will cost almost double that. The real estate firm Cushman & Wakefield said today Manhattan rents have reached a new record, but the Big Apple may still be a bargain. According to the study, it's only the world's ninth most expensive office market. London and Tokyo top the list. Mumbai, India, and Dublin are also ahead of New York. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 4 points. That's less than a tenth of 1%, but it was the eighth straight up day for the blue chips. The Nasdaq picked up 8 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 rose 3 points. That's about a quarter percent there. Next time, this tax season, you might find yourself doing some basic financial planning.
It's not really rocket science, right, in the sense that you're going to think about what your tax rate is now,
what your best guess in terms of the tax rate is going to be going forward, and what kind of rate of return you expect to get until you retire.
But look out, because that idea you just heard, it's patented. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll tell you about it tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.